Louis Longmont took Sally Jensen's elbow and helped her up the steps to board the train. As she stepped aboard, she dropped her purse and he bent to pick it up.
Whoa, Sally. What do you have in here, stones?
Sally smiled slightly and opened the purse for him to look inside. Nestled there was a chrome-plated Smith & Wesson 36 caliber short-barreled pistol.
Are you planning on robbing this train?
No, but if anyone thinks they're going to hang Smoke Jensen without first having to deal with his wife, they are sadly mistaken.
Louis looked back over his shoulder as Monte Carson kissed his wife Mary goodbye. Both men were accompanying Sally on the train ride to Fort Smith, Arkansas. They were planning on appearing as character witnesses for Smoke when he came to trial before Judge Isaac Parker. Sally, however, was planning on doing way more than that in the event it became necessary. She intended to break Smoke out of jail if the judge refused to listen to reason and sentenced him to hang. They quickly took their seats and the train got on its way.
Monty, do you think the judge will listen to us and believe Smoke is innocent?
The lawman slowly shook his head, a worried expression on his face.
Not from what I've heard. The word is Judge Parker is a man who believes fully in the law, spelled with a capital L. If he's got a witness who says he saw Smoke shoot a man in the back, then the judge is going to sentence him to hang, no doubt about it.
But Monty, you and Louis both know that if anyone says that about Smoke, they must be lying.
Of course we know that, Sally. The trick is going to be to convince the judge the man, whoever he is, must be lying for some reason known only to him.
Sally patted her purse, giving Louis a knowing look.
Well, if the man is in Fort Smith and he intends to lie about my husband, then I might just have to have a word with him before the trial.
We'll all have a talk with him, Sally. Don't you worry. If he's lying, Monty and I will make him admit it, one way or another.
At that very moment, Cal and Pearlie were riding slowly into the city limits of Jacksboro, Texas. Jacksboro, though much smaller, was a town not unlike Fort Worth and 20-odd miles to the northwest. Built around the cow business as well, but on a much smaller scale, the town consisted mostly of cattle pens, butchering houses, hotels, brothels, saloons, and eating establishments. The streets were awash with horses, buckboards, children, dogs, and men and women. Many people were walking up and down the wooden boardwalks that lined the dirty streets.
Jiminy, I never seen so many people one place at one time just rushing around in a hurry like.
Yep, they all running around like they gotta be someplace in a hell of a hurry. Wonder what the rush is all about.
How do you expect we'll ever find Gibbons and all these people? There must be 20 or more saloons and gambling houses.
Just have to start at one end of the town, make our way up and down the streets till we find the bastard. Sooner or later, he'll show up. Tinhorns can't hardly stay away from the poker games. They like a man with a powerful thirst for liquor. They always find some place to get what they need.
You want
to
start now?
Cal was eyeing the sun, which was nearing the horizon in the west.
Nah. Let's find a hotel and grab some grub and maybe a hot bath. My butt cheeks feel like they done growed to the saddle. I'm afraid I smell worse than some of the bees walking down the street over yonder.
After they'd gotten rooms at the Star Hotel on Main Street and partaken of a hot bath in the communal bathing room on the third floor, the boys went to the nearest restaurant and sat down to have some dinner. The diner was called the Hofbräu and was run by a heavyset German woman who spoke with a thick, almost guttural accent. Pearlie had to ask her several times what the different items on the menu were, and he finally just let her decide what he should have.
As long as there's plenty of it.
The big woman smiled and walked off toward the kitchen. After stuffing themselves on pot roast, German potato salad, and two slices of Dutch apple pie, washed down with a pot of coffee that was so strong Cal said he didn't think it needed a cup, they made their way toward the deputy sheriff's office, just off Main Street. When they walked through the office door, the first thing Cal and Pearlie noticed was the large number of iron-barred cells in the rear of the building, almost all of which were filled with prisoners.
Seems like the deputy sheriff does a right smart business in this town.
Most of the men appeared to be cowboys, probably just off cattle drives, who looked as if they'd partaken of too much cheap whiskey and not enough food.
Can I help you, gents?
The voice came from a tall, lean man on the side of the room. He was sitting behind an oak desk, scarred with numerous spur marks, with his feet up on the edge of the desk and a long black cigar protruding from his lips. He was dressed in black pants with a black vest over a boiled white shirt, and he had a thin string tie and a bow at his neck. He had a long handlebar mustache that reminded Cal of pictures he'd seen of Marshal Wyatt Earp in Tombstone, making Cal wonder if the resemblance was calculated on the deputy sheriff's part.
Howdy.
The deputy sheriff nodded, his eyes watching Cal and Pearly closely, as if he were trying to figure out if they were here to cause him some sort of problem.
Something I can help you with? You Deputy Sheriff Johnny Walker?
The man nodded, his right hand resting on the butt of his Colt, ready for trouble.
U.S. Marshal Heck Thomas told us to look you up. He said you might be able to help us find a man.
For the first time, Walker gave a slight smile.
Old Heck said that, did he?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, who is this man and what is he wanted for?
His name's Gibbons, and he's a tin-horn gambler. He gave a false statement to Marshal Thomas about a killing in Fort Worth, and then he skipped out of town.
You mean Heck sent you all the way down here just to look for a man whose only offense was lying? Hell, if I was to arrest every man in town who lied, there wouldn't be room for them all in the jail. Most of the men in Jacksboro are guilty of something a whole lot worse at some time in their lives. That's why they end up here instead of Fort Worth or some bigger town.
Now, this man lied about a friend of ours. He said he backshot a man outside a saloon. Now our friend's on his way to Fort Smith to be hanged.
Well, now, that's a horse of a different color. And Heck knows this man was lying when he said that.
Yes, sir. He overheard the man admit he'd lied, but before he could get him to change his statement, Gibbons left town.
Why don't Heck just tell the judge the story? That ought to take care of the matter.
The judge in question is Judge Isaac Parker. You ever dealt with him?
Oh, that do make it difficult. Old Judge Parker is a stickler for the legal niceties being followed, all right.
Sheriff, will you help us? Marshal Thomas said he'd consider it a personal favor.
Sure, boys. Just let me grab my hat and we'll get started looking for this tin horn. What kind of fella is this Gibbons? High class or low class?
What you mean?
Well, is he likely to go for a high-stakes game? Or try to find one with less money at stake?
I figure him more for the high-stakes game. He dresses real nice, and the night he saw the gunfight, he'd been at one of the best saloons in Fort Worth.
Then we'll start at the north end of Main Street. That's where all the gentlemen gamblers tend to congregate. The whores are pretty up there, too.
As the trio turned the corner onto Main Street and proceeded northward, the boys told Walker how they'd paid a whore to get Gibbons to incriminate himself.
Yep. Seems there's a woman behind the downfall of most men. That or liquor. Or both.
When they got to the end of the street, he pointed to several brightly lit establishments.
That there's the Lucky Lady. And over there's the Double Eagle and the Cattleman's Palace. Those would be the ones to start with.
Which one has the most women in it?
Son, this is a cow town. They all chock full of women.
The Lucky Lady's the closest. Let's try there first.
As the men walked into the saloon, a couple of the girls smiled and waved at Walker, showing he was no stranger to the establishments. And he waved back, a grin on his face. Pearly and Cal pulled their hats down low over their faces, so Gibbons wouldn't recognize them if he happened to look their way. And they began to weave among the many tables of card players, searching for the man they were after. It took them over half an hour to ascertain he was not in the Lucky Lady, while the deputy stayed at the bar, helping himself to a glass of beer and watching them as they searched.
Well, we can try the Cattleman's Palace next. It's right down the street.
It's funny, but the Cattleman's the name of the hotel we stayed in over in Fort Worth.
Not so funny when you think about it. Can't throw a stick in either town without hitting a cattleman, so it's only natural to put the name on places you want them to come to.
Smoke rode slowly toward Fort Worth, but his conscience would not let him be.
Damn it. Marshall doesn't know what he's getting himself into. Those nine men are hard cases who won't give up without a fight. Nine against one is tall odds, even for a man as good with a gun as Tillman is supposed to be. A horse? We gotta turn around. Couldn't live with myself if I'd let the Marshal go it alone. He got himself killed.
Smoke pulled the mount's head around and began following the Marshal's horse's prints toward the outlaw band. As he rode, he checked his pistols one at a time, making sure they were loaded up 6 and 6. And then he filled his pockets with extra cartridges, just in case the upcoming battle lasted longer than he expected. Smoke stayed well back, just barely keeping Tillman in sight on the horizon. He knew if the man knew Smoke was coming to help, he'd try and talk him out of it by saying it was his job, not Smoke's, to corral the desperados. No matter. Smoke intended to help only if it looked like the Marshal needed it. If he was doing all right by himself, Smoke would stay out of sight. It was almost dark when Smoke saw the Marshal up ahead get down off his horse and run, crouching to get behind a small copse of trees near the stream where Smoke had left Stillwell's band of men.
Come on, horse.
Smoke circled around to the west of where the Marshal was stalking the outlaws. He wanted to come at him from out of the setting sun if he had to intervene, using every advantage he could in the face of superior numbers. Smoke reached the edge of the small trickle of water downstream from the bandits.
All right, boys, put down your weapons and come out with your hands up.
Fat chance. They're gonna come out all right with hands filled with iron and guns blazing.
Smoke knew men like those he'd ridden with, men used to riding the Owl Hoot Trail, would not give up without a fight, and most probably they would fight to the death. Smoke got down off his horse and crept up the stream toward the men. The group of outlaws hunkered down behind the boles of cottonwood trees and in the shelter of the bank of the small stream they were camped next to. Jaime Gonzalez, he'd taken over leadership of the bandits after Stillwell had been killed by Smoke, glanced over George Hungry Bear, lying on his stomach behind a fallen log next to him.
Damn it! I thought that Marshal was out of it!
That Smoke Jensen must have gone to help him after killing Zack.
You think we can make the horses?
Gonzalez was referring to their horses, which they'd tied to another group of trees 50 yards away.
And do what? Ride them without saddles?
I thought you Injuns were good at that.
Hell, Jaime. I was raised on a reservation. I ain't never ridden bareback in my life, and I don't intend to start now. We got the White Eyes outnumbered. We just have to send some of the men sneaking around behind them, and this'll all be over in a little while.
Gonzalez looked to the other side, where the three men they'd rescued from Tillman were huddled together behind a large double-trunk cottonwood.
Hey! Dynamite Dick! How about you and your friends making your way off to the side and come at the Marshal from behind?
We ain't got no guns, remember? The Marshal took them from us when we was arrested.
Gonzalez pulled out an old Walker Army Colt from his second holster and pitched it over to Bodine.
Take this!
Bodine leaned out from behind the tree to pick up the pistol.
Jesus, hell, Jaime, this thing must weigh 4 pounds.
You want me to hold it for you?
Yeah, what about us?
Gonzalez nodded at Hungry Bear, who scooted back to his saddlebags and pulled out a couple of older model army revolvers. He threw them over to the men with Bodine.
Make your shots count! We ain't got a whole lot of extra ammo.
Mayhew took one of the armies and handed the other to Shorty Robinson.
I hope you're better with this than I am.
Robinson expertly flicked open the loading gate and checked the rounds.
Yeah, I guess you tinhorns are more used to derringers than real guns. This works the same way. You get close enough, don't matter where you hit him, he'll go down.
Gonzalez leaned back and shouted at Brooks Sullivan, a cattle rustler who was riding with Stillwell's gang.
Brooks! You and Willie Jackson sidle on downstream till you get out of the sight of the Marshal. Then crawl on up the hill till you're behind him. When Bodine and his men are ready on the other side, give a whistle, and we'll all charge in at once from different directions.
Brooks nodded and tapped Jackson on the shoulder, pulling him backward down toward the stream behind him. They crouched down so they'd have the cover of the shallow banks, and they began to wade downstream, looking back over their shoulders to make sure the Marshal couldn't see him. Once they'd rounded a corner out of sight, they straightened up and began to move faster.
Well, that goddamn long man ain't gonna know what hit him.
Brooks stopped talking when he saw Jackson's eyes widen in fear, staring ahead of him down the stream. Brooks jerked his head around in time to see a tall, broad-shouldered man standing there, his hands hanging at his sides.
Howdy, gents. Remember me?
Smoke Jensen!
This ain't your fight, Jensen. Why don't you just ride off and mind your own business?
It's a little late for that, boys. I've ended up in this game. You want to call my bet or fold?
Call!
Brooks grabbed for his pistol as Willie Jackson did the same. Smoke's Colt appeared in his hand as if by magic. Smoke hesitated just long enough to punch out his empties and reload before continuing his journey upstream.
What the hell was that?
Hungry Bear started to shake his head, but then he ducked as a slug from Tillman's Yellow Boy slammed into the log he was behind and showered his face with splinters and wood dust.
We gotta get out of here, or he's gonna pick us off one by one.
One of the other men, Sam Best, a gunman from Tombstone who'd left town at the urging of Wyatt Earp, jumped to his feet and began to run toward the horses. Gonzalez peered to the side, seeing that Bodine and Mayhew and Robinson were almost in position to fire on Tillman's back. He raised his head slightly to see better. Tillman's bullet took him exactly dead center in his Adam's apple, tearing a fist-sized hole in his throat. Hungry Bear rolled to the side, seeing Roy Bailey, an 18-year-old who fancied himself the next Billy the Kid, hiding in a mulberry bush next to a cottonwood off to the side. Bailey, evidently not as brave in a gunfight as he'd thought, had not shown himself since the marshal had attacked.
Bailey, climb up in that tree you're hiding behind and see if you can get a shot at the marshal.
But what if he sees me?
Then he'll shoot you dead, you yellow Billy. But if you don't do what I say, I'll kill you myself.
Slowly, being careful to remain out of sight, the young man began to climb the tree, his Henry thrown over his back on a rawhide strap. Just then, Dynamite Dick Bodine and Shorty Robinson jumped to their feet from 20 yards behind Marshal Tillman and began firing their pistols. Shorty Robinson's second shot took Tillman in the fleshy part of his left arm, knocking his rifle from his grasp and spinning him around, and thus saving his life. Bodine's first shot barely missed the Marshal when he spun to the side from the impact of being shot, and as was common with the Walker Colts, the second shot exploded in the firing chamber, taking Bodine's first two fingers of his right hand off at the first knuckle. As Bodine fell to the ground, Tillman drew his pistol and fired from his position lying on his back, hitting Shorty Robinson in the belly, doubling him over as he grabbed at the hole in his stomach, trying without success to keep his intestines in. Jonathan Mayhew started to point his pistol at the marshal, had second thoughts, and threw it to the ground, raising his hands over his head. Evidently, he figured he'd have a better chance with Judge Parker than with this angry-eyed lawman who was drawing a bead on his face.
Now I give up, Marshal. Please don't shoot me.
Lie down on your face and spread your hands out, Mayhew. And if you reach for that pistol, you're a dead man.
Hungry Bear looked up at Roy Bailey, hidden in the branches of the cottonwood, his rifle cradled in his arms.
You got a shot?
No! He's lying down and I can't get a bead on him.
Wait a minute. I'm gonna go out there with my hands up. When he shows himself to arrest me, you plug him good, you understand?
Right. Well, you get him to stand up and I take him down.
Marshal!
Yeah?
You killed all of us except me. I'm gonna throw my gun out and give myself up.
Come on. Don't you try nothing fancy or I'll drill you through and through.
Hungry Bear pitched his pistol over the log and stood up, his hands held high over his head. He stepped over the log and began to walk toward where Tillman lay. When Hungry Bear was out in the clear, away from his gun, the marshal stood up, motioning with his Colt for Mayhew to follow him toward the Indian. Mayhew and George Hungry Bear stood in front of Marshal Tillman, their hands up.
You men are under arrest.
Tillman whirled around, crouching, pointing his pistol toward the sound. A body, still holding a Henry repeating rifle, fell from a tree. A tall, dark figure stepped from the cover of the trees, his hands above his head.
Don't shoot, Marshal. Smoke Jensen.
As Smoke approached, the Marshal shook his head, grinning.
Jensen, thought you was on your way to Fort Worth.
I was, but I thought you might need a little backup.
That you I heard shooting over downstream a while back?
Yeah, a couple of the gang were on their way to sneak up on your back. I let them know that wasn't appreciated.
Yeah, I heard how you told them. Well, the .44 sounded like.
You need some help with that arm?
You can keep a gun on these galoots. I'll tie it off with my bandana. Then we can get them on their horses for the ride back to the wagon.
No problem, Marshal. You ought to have enough Brahms to pull it the rest of the way.
Yeah, and you can get back on your way to Fort Worth to finish your business there.
A bit later, Smoke started to ride away.
But Jansen! I've never let my personal feelings interfere with my work as a U.S. Marshal. Even though you probably saved my life by doing what you did. If you're still wanted for murder when I get to Fort Smith, I gotta tell you, I'll be coming after you, just like any other wanted man.
I appreciate the warning, Marshal. And I would expect nothing less.
Just want to let you know not to expect any special treatment because of today.
Don't worry about it, Marshal. I'm going to get this mess cleared up so there won't be any need for you having to track me down.
I hope so, Jansen. For your sake, because I always get my man. One way or another.
As he rode toward Fort Worth, Smoke realized he had to do some heavy thinking. It wasn't going to be enough to get that tin horn who said he'd seen Smoke shoot the Durango kid in the back to recant his testimony. Smoke was going to have to find the culprit who did the shooting to really clear his name. After all, he'd been the one found standing in the alleyway over the dead man's body. Smoke began to go through various possibilities in his mind. Murders weren't all that uncommon in the West, especially in cow towns like Fort Worth. Bumping a man's arm at a bar, stepping on his toes, or even stealing a whore he was wooing was often grounds for senseless violence. But to cold-bloodedly shoot a man in the back, well, that spoke of a hatred more intense than that usually occasioned by a barroom fight or an imagined insult. He figured the man who did him in had to be someone with a powerful hate or a real good reason to see the kid dead. And as he thought back over the events of that night, he remembered the kid had said they'd only just gotten into town with their bees the night before, so it would be unusual for him to have made such a deadly enemy so quickly. Smoke nodded as he continued to think it through. That meant the most likely suspects were the men riding with the kid. One or more of them would probably have reason to want the outlaw dead.
Money or women. Now all I have to do is track down the men who were riding with the kid, find out which one of them had the most reason and the opportunity to shoot him dead. I just hope they're still in town.
In Jacksboro, Cal and Pearlie had failed to find the gambler Gibbons on their first night of searching.
I'm sorry, boys.
Deputy Sheriff Johnny Walker spoke after trailing him through most of the saloons along Main Street.
I got to get back to my duties. I'll tell you what, you find that galoot, see if he's willing to change his story, and I'll write it all down for Marshal Thomas, and I'll even send a wire to Judge Parker over at Fort Smith.
Thanks, Sheriff. If we find him, I'll guarantee he'll tell the truth.
I hope so, boys, because if he don't change his story, I'm afraid the hanging judge is going to live up to his name with your partner.
With that, Walker left them at the lobby of their hotel.
What now, Pearlie? You want to walk around the rest of the night and see if we can find Gibbons some more?
No. If he was going to gamble tonight, he'd already be at the tables. Maybe he was so tired he took the night off to get some rest.
Or maybe he found himself a girl to spend the night with.
That's a possibility. I suggest we get some shut-eye and start out first thing in the morning. If we don't find him by lunchtime, we can take a nap and be fresh and ready to try again tomorrow night.
I just hope we're not too late for Smoke.
Don't you worry none about Smoke. He's been in plenty of worse situations than this. He can take care of himself.
It's not Smoke I'm worried about. It's the hanging judge. From what I hear, he's a mite too anxious to use that rope of his.
As soon as Smoke got to Fort Worth, he went to the Cattleman's Hotel, where he'd left Cal and Pearlie. He walked up to the desk clerk.
Can I have my key?
The man looked up from his register, a perfectly startled look on his face.
But I thought you were on your way to Fort Smith.
It was that same snooty dandy that had been on duty when Smoke and the boys first arrived.
New evidence came in, Jason. So Marshal Tillman let me go. Now, I'd like to get to my room, get a bath, and catch a little shut-eye after I talk to my friends.
Your friends left the other day.
Left?
Yep. They were all asking all over town about the gambler fellow. I can't bring his name to mind. And then they heard he went to Jacksboro, so they went after him.
Oh, well. Has my suite on the top floor been rented?
No, sir.
Now give me the key and see if you can get the bath boy to heat up some water.
But it's the middle of the day.
The dandy's face was aghast at the idea of anyone bathing before darkness came.
Jason, I haven't bathed in almost a week. Get the water hot and give me my key before I come across that desk and teach you how to do your job.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jansen.
Jason sleeved sweat off his forehead with the back of his arm as he handed the key across the desk to Smoke. After his bath, Smoke slept the rest of the afternoon, getting up just after sundown. He dressed in clean clothes, electing to wear black trousers, a white shirt under a black vest, and no coat, since the cool spring nights were mild. He ate a hearty dinner at the Cattleman's Hotel, then went looking for the kid's friends. He knew the kid and his men had liked the Silver Dollar, but that was where he'd first met him, so he headed there to begin his search. Smoke eased through the bat wings and stepped to the side, as was his habit, observing the room for possible danger before entering. He didn't know if Cal and Pearlie had talked with Marshal Heck Thomas, or even if the Marshal was still in town, but he didn't want to meet up with him until he'd had a chance to do some looking around. He saw no one familiar, so he made his way to the bar and ordered a mug of beer. It looked to be a long night of searching, so he stayed away from the whiskey. He took his mug and leaned back with his elbows on the bar, looking for the women who'd been entertaining the kid and his friends the night of the killing. Building himself a cigarette, he drank and smoked slowly, waiting for one or another of the women to show themselves. Finally, while on his second beer, Smoke saw one of the women come down the stairs, her arm around the waist of a drunken cowboy. He got the bartender's attention and nodded at the girl.
What's the lady's name?
She ain't exactly a lady, but her name's Dolly.
Smoke grinned as he glanced at the barman.
Seen Marshal Thomas around lately?
No, thank goodness. Word is he's riding around all the local ranchers asking some questions about stolen beeves. Good thing, too. Every time he comes in here, I lose business. Ain't nobody likes to drink and carouse with a U.S. Marshal looking over their shoulders.
Smoke threw a coin on the table and touched his hat.
Thanks for the information.
Well, you want to talk to Dolly?
Yeah. I'm going to go over to that table in the corner. Why don't you send her and a bottle of whiskey over?
Yes, sir.
Smoke carried his beer to the table and took a seat, his back to the wall, just in case the kid's friends happened to come in. He was relieved he didn't have to worry about running into Marshal Thomas for a while. That made things a whole lot simpler. After a few minutes, he saw the bartender whisper into Dolly's ear. She glanced his way, smiled, and disengaged herself from the grasp of the drunken cowboy. Grabbing the whiskey bottle and a couple of glasses from the barman, she began to walk towards Smoke, grinning and waggling her hips as she moved through the crowd. She took a seat next to Smoke at the table, sitting so close their hips touched.
Howdy, cowboy. Max over at the bar said you asked for me special.
That's right.
Dolly deftly pulled the cork from the bottle and poured them both drinks, hers slightly heavier than his.
Here's to a good night and a morning without a hangover.
Smoke touched glasses and took a small sip of his whiskey.
You want to drink for a while or just head on upstairs?
Let's talk for a while.
Well, Mr. Drink will buy you a little time, but for serious talk, it's going to cost you more than that.
Smoke pulled a double eagle gold coin from his shirt pocket and placed it in her hand.
$20? Hell, cowboy, for that much you get all night.
Smoke knew that the going rate for all night was closer to $5, but he didn't say anything. He kept the conversation to generalities until Dolly had downed several drinks. He was hoping to get her drunk enough to not be suspicious when he began asking her questions about the kid and his men. After a while, she stared at him.
I don't remember entertaining you before, mister, and believe me, I'd remember you.
No, we haven't met before.
Then why'd you ask for me? Somebody give you my name?
It was the perfect opening for Smoke.
Yeah, I saw you with some men several days ago.
A tall man dressed in black, a Mexican with three fingers on his left hand, and two other gents.
Oh, them.
You remember them?
Sure. Only one in the group who was willing to spend any money went and got himself shot before I could get him upstairs.
Oh?
Yeah, and the other galoots were so cheap they thought buying me and Susie a few drinks entitled them to take liberties, if you know what I mean.
Smoke nodded.
We finally told him how the cow ate the cabbage. If you want to play, you gotta pay.
Smoke was beginning to like this Dolly. She was plain-spoken, but she definitely had more personality than most women in her line of work.
Have they been back?
No. When they found out we wasn't giving it away, they kind of lost interest. Said they had to sell some cattle before they could spend that kind of money on whores.
You know where they are now?
Dolly's eyes suddenly became sharp.
Oh, so this isn't about you and me. It's about them cowboys, ain't it?
Yes, it is.
What's it worth to you if I can find out where they're staying?
You can keep that double eagle, and I won't make you earn it.
Now, who said I'd mind earning it with you?
You can keep the coin, and I'll give you another just like it, if you let me know next time you see them. Or can find out what hotel they're staying at.
Now you're talking. Where are you staying, cowboy?
The name's Jensen, and I'm at the Cattleman's Hotel.
Dolly raised her eyebrows at the mention of his hotel, which was about the swankiest in town.
Well, I'll start asking around. I should hear something by tomorrow night.
Dolly, be careful. These men are dangerous. Don't let them find out you're asking around about them.
Dolly bent down and pulled the hem of her dress up, exposing a garter on her leg, holding a double-barreled derringer.
You think they're dangerous, honey? You ain't seen Dolly at work.
Cal and Pearlie, after sleeping most of the afternoon, arose just before sundown and went to a local eatery for dinner. Pearlie, as usual, ate enough for two men, while Cal, who was worried about Smoke, hardly touched his meal.
You gotta put some vittles in your gut, Cal. You can't do Smoke no good if you're famished.
I'll eat when we get the statement from Gibbons. I just don't have no appetite thinking of Smoke in that jail in Fort Smith.
All right, then. Let's get to it.
Pearlie paid their bill, and they walked out on the main street.
Where do you think we ought to try next?
Well, we tried all the highfalutin places last night and didn't see hide nor hair of the galoot. Maybe you're short of cash and can't afford the high-stakes games. Tonight, let's hit the places down by the Mexican quarter. Maybe we'll find them there.
They turned left on Main and walked five blocks, then took another left toward the cattle yards where the lower-class part of town was. Its residents were mainly Mexicans, blacks, and working-class whites. And the area had several cantinas and bars that were downright dangerous to enter. According to Johnny Walker, even he didn't go into the area at night unless backed up by at least two other deputies. As they walked, Cal and Pearlie both loosened the rawhide hammer guards on their pistols, ready just in case of trouble. In the third place they entered, which had the unlikely name El Gato Negro, the Black Cat, they found their man. The saloon was made of adobe and had low ceilings and dirt floors. With the few lanterns and hazy, smoky air, it was hard to see more than 10 feet in front of your face. But the boys recognized Gibbons' flashy yellow and black plaid coat from across the room.
There the sumbitch is. You sidle on around to get between him and the back door, and I'll ease up on him from the front.
Pearlie?
Yeah?
Watch your back. Those men he's playing with look awful hard to me.
Pearlie nodded. Cal was right. At the table with Gibbons were two Mexicans with long handlebar mustaches, both wearing large Colt Army pistols on their belts and knives in scabbards stuck in their pants. A huge, six-foot-tall black man wearing an undershirt and pants held up with a rope was the fourth man at the table. Cal moved through the crowd of drunken men until he was standing in front of the rear door, one leading back to the privy in the alley behind the saloon. He leaned back against the wall next to the door and let his hand rest on the butt of his pistol, sweating nervously as he watched the milling crowd in the small room. Pearlie walked over to stand behind and to the side of Gibbons, out of sight of the gambler. He noticed most of the money and poker chips at the table were piled in front of the tin horn, and that the other men at the table were staring at Gibbons with ill-concealed anger. Gibbons must have sensed he was in over his head, but when he turned and saw Pearlie standing beside him, he grinned nervously and greeted Pearlie like an old friend.
Why, Pearlie, how are you doing?
Pearlie nodded at the pile of money in front of Gibbons.
Pick up your winnings, Gibbons. We got to talk.
Gladly, my boy, gladly.
The gambler took off his hat and raked the bills, chips, and coins into it.
Wait a minute, senor. The gringo has won all monies. He cannot leave.
Gibbons held out his hand in a placating manner.
Don't worry, Jose. I'm just going out to the privy to relieve myself and talk to these gentlemen for a moment. I'll be right back.
Well, you better, mister. I'll cut you up real good.
Pearlie noticed a large man had a machete stuck through the rope in his pants. Gibbons nodded, smiling and grinning as sweat ran down from his forehead to drip off his chin.
Come on, Pearlie. Let's go out back and settle this.
Pearlie followed him out the back door, picking up Cal on the way. Once outside, Pearlie grabbed Gibbons and swung him around.
You gonna change that lying statement you gave to Marshal Tillman?
Gibbons held up his hands, palms outward.
Pearlie, I'll sign anything you want if you get me out of here. Now, these men are not very gracious losers, and I'm afraid they plan to do me bodily harm if they don't win their money back.
Pearlie turned at the sound. The Mexicans were standing there, both with large pistols in their hands. One of them held up a pair of aces.
You left these behind you, senor. They fell out of your coat when you left the table.
Oh, why, those aren't mine.
Lying gringo!
Both Mexicans turned their pistols on Cal and Pearlie, who were standing there open-mouthed at the suddenness of the violence.
Please be so kind as to not move, senors.
One of the Mexicans walked over to Gibbons' dead body and removed his hat. The man emptied the money out of it and set it gently back down on Gibbons' skull.
Adios, senors.
The Mexicans took off running down the alleyway.
God damn!
Pearlie pulled Cal down the alley away from the direction the Mexicans took.
Let's get the hell out of here before someone comes out and accuses us of killing Gibbons.
What about Smoke?
We're gonna have to find some other way to clear him. Because Gibbons sure as hell ain't gonna change his statement now.
Pearlie and Cal walked back over to Main Street and entered Deputy Sheriff Johnny Walker's office. As usual, Walker was sitting back in his chair with his feet up on his desk, sipping coffee out of a stained mug.
Howdy, boys. You find that tin horn yet?
Yeah, we found him. Trouble is, a couple of Mexes put a .44 slug in his chest. He's lying in the privy out back of the Black Cat Cantina.
I don't suppose there are any witnesses to say you boys didn't do it, are there?
Sheriff, you know we needed him to save our friend's life. We wouldn't have killed him.
I suppose that does make sense.
You gonna go over there and check it out?
You say you're sure he's dead?
Deader than a stone.
I don't see no sense in bothering about it tonight. I'll amble on over there at first light in the morning.
Sheriff, after the gunshot, no one even came out of the cantina to see what was happening.
No, I don't expect they did.
Isn't that a little strange?
You boys know how many men get killed in that area every night?
The boys shook their heads.
Enough, so there's not nothing anybody over there gets too excited about. Hell, they'll probably go on using the privy, too, after moving him to the side a bit. Not even say nothing about it.
What you suggest we do now?
Seems to me, the only chance of helping your friend is to find out who really killed the man in Fort Worth. Was it me? I go back there and see what I can dig up.
He's right, Cal.
Then let's go. Smoke don't have much time left.
Sally Jensen, followed by Monty Carson and Louis Longmont, walked right by the clerk guarding the door to Judge Isaac Parker's chamber.
Hey, miss, you can't do that.
Sally, without pausing, turned steel-hard eyes on the boy and pointed her finger at him.
Sit.
Sally put her hand on the door and pushed it open. The young clerk stared open-mouthed at Louis and Monty as they followed Sally into the room. Parker looked up from his desk, tilting his head to see over the half glasses on his nose.
What is the meaning of this interruption of my work?
Undaunted, Sally strode right up in front of his desk and stood there, staring down at the judge. He was in his mid-30s, dark-haired, and wore a dark gray suit and vest over a white shirt and black bow tie. His face appeared stern, and his visage was serious.
My name is Sally Jensen, and I've come to talk to my husband.
I don't handle visitation of prisoners, ma'am. You'll have to speak to the superintendent of jails. Didn't my clerk inform you of that fact?
I'm afraid the young man didn't have a chance to inform us of anything, Your Honor.
Parker cut his eyes to Lewis.
And just who might you be?
I'm Lewis Longmont, Your Honor. Pleased to make your acquaintance.
Parker's eyes roamed to Monte Carson next, who took off his hat and held it in both hands in front of him.
I'm Monte Carson, Judge, Sheriff of Big Rock, Colorado.
Parker steepled his hands under his chin and glared at the group standing in front of his desk.
I presume you all have some reason for being here?
We've been to the superintendent of jails, Judge Parker, and he said there is no one in jail by the name of Smoke Jensen.
Ah, so you're Smoke Jensen's wife. I've heard a great deal about your husband, especially in the last couple of weeks.
Then you know Smoke couldn't possibly have shot a man in the back.
I noticed you didn't say your husband couldn't possibly have shot the man, just that he didn't do it in the back.
Of course he could have shot the man, given adequate provocation. My husband is a famous shootist, Judge, and this is the West. On occasion, men come up to Smoke and try to get a reputation, or to prove their bravery. Most times he can talk them out of trying his hand with a gun, but sometimes it just isn't possible, and he has to kill them. He regrets it, but he simply does not instigate confrontations, and he is so proficient with his firearms that he does not need to shoot anyone in the back.
I see. So your husband has killed many men, Mrs. Jensen.
Sally's eyes became flat, and she gave him a look that would curdle milk.
As have you, Judge Parker.
Surely you're not comparing me to a gunfighter.
No. A gunfighter shoots in self-defense and puts his own life on the line, while you hide behind those law books on your shelves and make your judgments with no risk to yourself. But the end result is the same. One man is alive, one man left dead.
Sally regretted her words almost immediately. She could tell by the hurt look on the judge's face that he was wounded by her accusation, and she remembered hearing that he often shed tears when sentencing a man to die by hanging. He looked off out his window, which overlooked the scaffold in the distance on which so many men had died by his pronouncements.
Please, Mrs. Jensen, take a seat.
Sally, Lewis, and Monty sat down, waiting to see what Parker had to say. After a moment, he spoke. His eyes soft now, with none of their former arrogance.
First of all, Mrs. Jensen, I'll tell you what I tell all the men I sentenced to hang. It is not me that is killing these men. It is the law. The law they broke when they murdered or raped or robbed someone. I'm only its instrument, carrying out the justice demanded by the men who wrote the laws in the first place, and by the society which demanded a code of conduct that, if broken, must be punished.
I know that, Judge Parker. And I apologize if I offended you. But you must also realize that I am fighting for my husband's life. He's a man I know as well as anyone can know another human being. And I know that he could not have done the crime of which he's being accused.
Then he will be set free, Mrs. Jensen. On that, you have my word.
Excuse me, Judge, but it's not as simple as that. You and I both know that innocent men have been convicted of crimes they did not commit. That is a fact. And that is what we aim to prevent, if we can help it.
Before the judge could respond, Monty leaned forward in his chair.
Judge, we heard someone had given testimony that he saw Smoke shoot the man in the back. Is that true?
Parker looked at a stack of papers on his desk and thumbed through them, looking for a copy of the wire he'd received.
Here we are. You are right, sir. There is such a testimony on record.
Parker read on further for a moment.
However, Marshal Heck Thomas says he has evidence the man was lying in his statement and is taking steps to get it revised.
The three visitors looked at each other, relief on their faces.
There, Judge. I told you so.
Hold on a minute, Mrs. Jensen. As I told Marshal Thomas in a reply to his telegram, the original statement will hold if the witness does not recant his testimony. That is the law.
So even though a sworn peace officer of this court tells you the witness is lying, you're still going to rely on perjured testimony?
I have no choice, Mr. Longmont. As I said, it is the law.
Then the law is in error.
May we see my husband, Judge Parker?
Oh, I thought you knew.
Knew what?
There has been some delay in his arrival here. Marshal Bill Tillman was bringing him, along with three other miscreants, overland by caged wagon, and he has failed to arrive on schedule.
What has happened to them?
I do not know, Mrs. Jensen. We have received no word from either Marshal Tillman or any other law enforcement officers concerning these prisoners.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
The judge looked uncomfortable, and he wouldn't meet Sally's eyes.
Mrs. Jensen, you have to realize, our U.S. Marshals each cover thousands of square miles of wilderness territory. They go out alone and come back alone. We simply do not have the manpower to provide them with adequate backup. They are, in a very real sense, on their own out there.
Do you really expect me to just sit here and wait to hear if my husband is alive or dead?
For the first time in the meeting, the judge grinned, just slightly.
No, Mrs. Jensen. After meeting you, I am quite sure that that is the last thing a lady such as yourself would do.
Parker bent his head and scribbled a quick note.
If you will give this to one of the marshals in the main office, one of them will show you on a map the route Tilleman would most likely take to bring your husband here from Fort Worth. And then you may go out and meet him, or to see what might have befallen him on the trip here.
Sally took the note and turned without another word, hurrying out the door. Lewis took the time to tip his hat at Judge Parker.
Thank you for your courtesy, sir.
Parker's eyes remained on Sally's back as she left the room.
She is quite a woman, isn't she?
She is that, all right.
This Jensen fellow may or may not be a murderer, but after meeting his wife, I'd say either way, he is one of the luckiest men in the world.
You're right, Judge. They just don't make him like Sally Jensen very often. In fact, I'm quite sure she is unique among women.
After Lewis and Monty and Sally had gone, Parker got a fresh sheet of paper and began writing a telegram to be sent to Marshal Heck Thomas in Fort Worth.
Marshal Thomas, I have come to believe you may be correct in proposing Jensen's innocence. Spare no expense in investigating the aforementioned affair. I want to get at the truth of this matter.
Dolly, the prostitute Smoke had talked to about the Durango Kids men, waited until the bartender began to shut the Silver Dollar Saloon down before making her move. She checked the loads in the Derringer and her garter, then made her way down Main Street to the Star Hotel. She knew the men who'd been riding with the Durango Kid were staying there, but she hadn't mentioned the fact to Smoke Jensen. She figured she might be able to get more money from the men by not telling of their whereabouts than from the big, handsome cowboy who braced her in the saloon. Dolly, on her own since the age of 14 when her stepfather raped her and then threw her out of the house, had learned the hard way that a girl had to take care of herself. Because sure as hell, no one else was gonna do it. When she stepped through the door of the Star, the clerk, dozing at the main desk, woke up and scowled at her.
We don't allow no whores in here.
Dolly glared at him for a moment, but then she forced herself to smile. After all, the one thing she'd learned in her years earning a living on her back was that a smile would get most of what she needed from most men.
Excuse me, sir. I have personal business with some of your guests. I am in possession of information they urgently need. I'm sure they would be most upset if you kept me from seeing them.
What guests?
Misters Juan Gomez, Jack Cummings, and Bob Gatlin.
Evidently, the man knew whom she was talking about, and he did not want to anger him. As he remembered, they were indeed hard-looking men.
Top of the stairs, on the left, rooms 302 through 304.
Dolly climbed the stairs, looking around at the lavish furnishings of the elegant hotel. It wasn't often, well, hell, it was never that she got to see such opulence. She felt sure she'd been right in her decision not to tell the tall man about where these men were staying. If they could afford this hotel, then they could afford to pay her a lot of money to keep their secret. The thought that she'd be walking into danger never even entered her mind. In her profession, danger was an everyday occurrence and was accepted as the price of doing business. She knocked on the door to room 302, fluffing her hair a bit to make herself appear more attractive.
Who is it?
A friend.
One eye peered out, checking the corridor behind Dolly to make sure she was alone before opening the door fully. Three Fingers Juan Gomez opened the door and stepped out into the hall, a Colt hanging from his right hand.
What do you want? I didn't order no girl.
I have some information I thought you might like to have. It concerns your friend who was killed the other night.
Yeah? What is it?
Dolly glanced up and down the hall.
I don't believe you'd want me to go into it out here in the corridor where just anyone could overhear.
Gomez considered this for a moment, and then stepped aside, letting her into his room. She crossed the small space and took a seat in a chair by the window, arranging her skirts as she sat so she could get to her derringer quickly if the need arose.
All right. Tell me.
Well, the information is rather important, and I was hoping you'd offer to pay me for my trouble in bringing it to you at such a late hour.
I ain't paying you nothing, girl. Now you tell me what you gotta tell me, or I'll just have to beat it out of you.
Dolly smiled, causing Gomez to assume a worried expression. He wasn't used to women not being afraid of him when he threatened them.
I'm sorry, sir, but I've already been offered $20 for the information from another fellow. If you don't want to pay, that's fine.
Dolly started to get up from her chair.
I'll just go to this other gentleman and sell him what I know.
Gomez was across the room in a flash. He grabbed Dolly by the throat, his eyes wild with anger.
I thought you go threatening me a little hard. Are you gonna tell me or do I have to hurt you?
Without taking her eyes off Gomez's face, Dolly reached under her skirt and brought out the derringer. She thumbed back the double hammers and stuck the twin barrels under the point of Gomez's chin.
Just how do you plan to hurt me, sir, with what little brains you have scattered all over the ceiling?
Gomez's eyes rolled downward, and he released Dolly's throat, holding his hands high above his head.
Be careful with that, miss. He's liable to go off.
If it does, you'll never hear it, Poncho.
Dolly pushed him back and walked over to his bed, where he'd laid his Colt. She picked it up and let the hammers down on the derringer.
Colt makes a much nicer hole than that little pop gun, don't you think?
Gomez didn't answer. He couldn't take his eyes off the barrel of the Colt, which was pointing right at his groin.
Perhaps I'm talking to the wrong man. Why don't we wake your friends up and see if they might be more reasonable about paying me for information that is vital to your survival?
Dolly put the gun under her overcoat and followed Gomez as he went to the adjoining rooms and managed to get his friends awake. They all gathered in Curly Bob Gatling's room. The three men sat next to each other on the bed, while Dolly sat across the room in a chair, the big Colt resting on her lap.
Now, gentlemen, what am I bid for what I know?
The three looked at each other.
We can give you $20.
I've told the Mex here I've already been offered $20 and I wouldn't have had to go to all this trouble. No, gentlemen, you're going to have to sweeten the pot a little to ante up in this game.
The men put their heads together.
We might be able to get $40 together, but that's all we got. We got some beeves for sale, but we ain't got the money for them just yet.
Dolly pursed her lips, thinking. $40 was all right, especially if it was all they had. After all, there was nothing to keep her from selling the same information to the man who called himself Smoke after she'd made her deal here.
All right, get it.
The men fumbled in their pockets and then finally had to go to some saddlebags lying on the dresser to get the money together. Curly Bob took the handful of crumpled bills and reached across the room to hand it to Dolly. She took the bills without taking her hand off the Colt.
Now, just what is so all-fired important that we'd be willing to pay $40 to hear?
Two things. Word on the street is that Marshal Heck Thomas is going around to all the local ranchers checking up to see if anyone sold you those beeves you're wanting to sell. So, if you plan to get rid of them and get out of town, you'd better hurry.
What made you think our cattle are stolen?
Oh, please. I've been entertaining cowboys for years now, and if you three ever earned a dime herding or selling beeves, I'll eat this here colt.
Curly Bob was beginning to like this woman. She knew how to read men.
What else do you have for us?
There's this tall, good-looking gent, goes by the name Smoke Jensen, asking around town about you boys. Seems he wants to meet with you in the worst way.
Jensen? I thought they marshal arrested him and hauled his ass out to Fort Smith.
Must have been a quick trip.
What's he want with us?
Says he wants to talk with you boys about finding out who killed your friend, the Durango Kid.
Oh, that don't make no sense. I thought Jensen killed him.
Gomez, who'd begun to sweat at the mention of Smoke Jensen, stood up.
That all you got to say?
Yes, for now.
Dolly also stood up and moved toward the door.
However, if I hear anything else, I'll be sure to give you gentlemen a chance to buy it. That is, if you live long enough to sell those beeves you got stashed at the edge of town.
Gomez took a step toward her, but Dolly eared back the hammer on the colt.
Now, Poncho, don't do anything stupid, all right? I'd hate to wake everyone in the hotel up by blowing your guts all over the wall.
Gomez stopped and backed up, sweat pouring from his forehead.
I can see that the idea that Smoke Jensen wants to talk to you about your friend's death has upset you.
Dolly glanced at Curly Bob and Rawhide Jack.
Perhaps you gentlemen better have a talk with your friend here before Smoke finds you. It appears he might know more than you do about who shot the kid.
Dolly opened the door and stepped out into the hall.
I'll just leave your pistol in the next room on my way out. But gentlemen, don't try and come after me for a little while, because I may just stand out here in the hall to see if anyone tries to open this door. Good morning, gents. I'll see you later.
Curly Bob stepped around to stand in front of Gomez.
Just what the hell did she mean about you knowing something about the kid's murder?
When Gomez's eyes shifted back and forth and he refused to meet Curly Bob's gaze, Gatling knew Dolly had been right.
Out with it, Three Fingers. What did she mean?
I don't know what she's talking about. She's just some crazy whore.
Curly Bob stepped over to the bedpost where his holster was hanging. He pulled out his pistol, and he pointed it at Three Fingers Gomez.
We've been riding together a long time, Three Fingers. It'd be a shame for me to have to drill you.
Gomez wilted, sitting on the edge of the bed with his head in his hands.
I just couldn't stand it no more. That kid was always writing me about being Mexican, telling me I wasn't going to get my fair share of the money from the beefs, me having to stay over on the west side of town and all.
So you telling us you shot the kid in the back?
I don't know what came over me, boys. When the kid went down into the alley to brace Jensen, I snuck out the back door to see if he gets shot. Before I knew it, my six gun was in my hand and I shot him in the back.
God damn it, Three Fingers, we was partners.
You was partners. Remember, that kid was always saying I wasn't going to get my fair share when we divvied up the money.
All right. It's over and done with now. And I gotta agree with Gomez. The kid did ride him awful hard.
Yeah, but now we not only got this Marshal Thomas on our back trail, we got Jensen to worry about.
That's true. But I think I see a way out of our troubles. Three Fingers, didn't you say you met a vaquero up from Mexico over at the cantina wanted to buy our beeves the other night?
Well, yeah. Only he wasn't offering as much as the kid wanted.
Well, thanks to you, the kid ain't around no more to object, is he?
No, And being as how we always splitting the money three ways instead of four, it could be almost the same amount to us anyway.
Well, that's about the first smart thing you said since I met you. Now, my idea is to sell those beeves to the Mex as fast as we can to get some ready cash so we can hightail it out of Fort Worth.
Well, that might get the marshal off our backs, but what about this Jensen fella?
We might just have to use some of Three Fingers' share to buy us some insurance. While we're over at the cantina making our deal with the Mex, we'll see if we can find some hard cases who might want to earn some spending money by taking Jensen out.
What do you mean, out of my share?
It was you who caused him to be on our backs. It's only fair you pay to get him off them.